My guest is writer Eileen Simpson. A recent loss led her to write a memoir about a childhood loss. Eileen Simpson was orphaned as a young child. When she came of age, she thought she left her orphanhood behind. But when her second husband died, she found herself feeling profoundly orphaned. That loss led her back to her youth and to a book on orphans she had started researching while her husband was still alive. Her new book is titled Orphans, Real and Imaginary. The first part is a memoir of her childhood. Eileen Simpson was 11 months old when her mother died. Her father died when she was 7. She and her sister grew up in a convent boarding school and in an institution for sickly children, as well as in the homes of various aunts and uncles. The second half of Orphans Real and Imaginary is about how orphans are treated in society and written about in literature. Eileen Simpson is also the author of the memoir Poets in Their Youth, about her marriage to the poet John Berryman. It's about being an artist's wife and about being a woman on the periphery of a circle of self-destructive male artists. Eileen Simpson lives in New York City, where she works as a psychotherapist. Eileen Simpson, welcome to Fresh Air. I like your writing very much, and I'd like to ask you to read the first paragraph of your new book, Orphans.
Throughout my adult life, when people asked about my childhood, and I said I was an orphan, their surprised looks made me quickly add, a lucky one. From the long, gray, early years, I had emerged unscathed. Hospitable to happiness, tenacious in adversity, of neither had I been cheated, I appeared to myself, as to others, cheerful and well-balanced. Even the physical weaknesses traceable to my early medical history were masked by high coloring that made me appear healthier than I was. As people said, I didn't look like an orphan.
And you didn't feel like an orphan.
No, I didn't.
Either. Going back to write this book, did you realize ways that you had been affected by the experience that you weren't aware of before?
Yes. In fact, it was a revelatory exploration. I thought when I began it that I really knew about my past, that there were not going to be any surprises there, and that what was going to be new and interesting was an exploration of the lives of other orphans in institutions and as portrayed in literature. And as I got into the work, beginning to write about my own life, I had to do research. I had to go back to records about my orphanhood. And there was a great deal that I hadn't known.
I think, in a way, you must have felt normal as an orphan because you were always surrounded by other orphans, and that was your reality.
Yes. And many of the other orphans who have written accounts use the expression about being, in their case, in orphanages. We were all in the same boat. And that's very different from what happened to the children, orphans, who were, for example, sent to farms out in the West, where they were taken from an orphanage, which was a kind of immense family, to an isolated life where they were the only child with a man and woman who had taken them in.
So you felt fairly normal being surrounded by other orphans like yourself. But to give us a sense of how different your life was in a way, I'd really like you to describe the bathing garment that you had to wear when you were in the convent boarding school for orphans.
The bathing garment, by the way, I've since heard of other people who had to wear them, was made of unbleached muslin, a kind of heavy, coarse fabric, and I suppose it was made of that because it was inexpensive, and it was cut like a sleeveless garment, absolutely straight and plain, and that's what we wore in the water, and washed, scrubbed over the garment.
This was the level of modesty. You weren't allowed to bathe naked. You bathed with the garment on.
Yes, and I think, by the way, that that continued in some institutions in Europe even longer than it did here. I mean, in Italian schools, I think this was not at all uncommon for quite a long time.
You had another experience that I suppose was fairly typical for sickly children at the time, but I had really never heard of it before, the Preventorium, which was an institution for children who were susceptible to tuberculosis, which is what your mother died of.
Yes, it was. They were institutions to which they sent, doctors sent, pre-tubercular children all over the United States. They were established at the time when what was called the War Against the Great White Plague began. And it was a concerted effort on all levels, with adults and with children, to wipe out tuberculosis. And later on in the book, I talk about the English poet Stevie Smith, and she was in a similar institution in England, where she went because she had some pre-tubercular condition.
I think for an outsider, you would assume that you would have been very happy when you were released from the preventorium and from the convent boarding school and sent to homes of aunts and uncles. But it wasn't necessarily more pleasant for you. And you say that it was being in the homes of aunts and uncles, you were on a smaller stage and a more claustrophobic one.
Yes. See, in an institution, that everybody's moving in lockstep. And that, of course, has its disadvantages. It's sort of a military routine, but everybody is doing the same thing. There are no favorites. There are no exceptions. When a child is taken from an institution and goes to live with in a household with adults, there are many differences. One of the first ones is, I think, that the child becomes aware of moods. That is to say, you are living much more intimately with adults, and you feel how it is they feel toward you. And they, if there are other children in the household, you become aware of preferences, of favoritism, of special dispensations. None of that, at least in my case, I was certainly not aware of any of that when I was in either of the schools. And I think that's true of many institutionalized children when they go to live in a household where everything is closer together.
When you also went to live in a household, you entered the world of children and parents. And what did you realize you were missing when you were exposed to parents?
Well, I think that was the first time I really felt I don't have them. I don't have somebody who is my special person, my protector, my defender, the person who will indulge me, comfort me. I felt, I think, much more exposed, much more orphaned.
When you came of age, you got an apartment in Greenwich Village, and a lot of friends had made you offers, come be a roommate with me. But no, you rented an apartment by yourself in Greenwich Village. And I wonder what the attraction was for you to live there.
Well, I think the first attraction was, although it had very much a romantic aura to all of us who went to college in New York, but for me there was an added quality. It was not just a center of bohemian life. It's the place where my father had lived. After my mother died, his family lived in Chelsea, which is where we stayed when we came home from boarding school. But then we would go to visit him, or he would take us down for the day or for 2 days to his bachelor flat, which was right around the corner from where I later lived, on 12th Street. And so for me, that was an extremely glamorous neighborhood.
What's interesting for me about your choice to move there is that Greenwich Village as a place for bohemians is, in a way, a place where people escape their past, a place where people run away to leave their parents and go to. And you must have fit in a way, better there than you would have in other places, because so many people are getting away from their families when they go there.
Yes, and it's amusing that later on, when I went to live there, my last year in college with my guardian, in fact, in an apartment on 12th Street, when I left home ran away from home. I ran across 6th Avenue. I ran across the street. My first room in a rooming house was on 12th Street, but between just one avenue west. But that was a much sort of racier neighborhood than where I had been before.
You write that in college it surprised you when you realized how agonizing the relationships between your friends and their parents frequently were. And I guess that's something that you hadn't been exposed to, because you were talking about how you realized that the parent-child relationship was very special. It was something you were deprived of. But then just a few years later, you saw the flip side of that.
Yes. And I think that had a profound effect on me. I think I became so interested in the relationship between children and their parents that it was one of the things that directed me to my profession.
Psychotherapy.
Yes. Because I looked at it with great interest. I mean, here was a whole new world that I didn't know about. I mean, first I'd had the revelation of children with their parents. That came late. Then the later one was children, late adolescents, very unhappily with their parents, envying me my orphan state.
You must have been really confused to have friends wishing that they were orphans like you.
In a way, not, because, you see, I'd always told myself that I didn't want other parents. I only wanted the ones that I had. In fact, I didn't even know that I wanted a mother. That was the last thing that occurred to me. In fact, I didn't learn that until I wrote the book. I thought I wanted a father. That I was always aware of. But it was just, I could see I became aware of the ambivalence in those relationships. They were not all good or all bad. They were torn relationships. And I suppose I focused on that much more intently because I was looking at it as an outsider.
Why do you think some people end up, especially at that age, in the late teens, early 20s, wishing that they had been orphans? Do you think it's a desire to rewrite your past and transform yourself into something other than what you think you are?
Well, you know, one of the things that I've learned even more acutely since I finished the book is how many people are convinced in childhood that they are orphans and that those people who pretend to be their parents are not. I have a little suspicion that I haven't been able to, I'm not certain of this yet, that it is maybe more acute in boys. But especially gifted children are convinced that these commonplace people can't be their parents, because how is it that they are so smart or so gifted and they see that their parents are not? Or if they're an only child, if those are really their parents, why don't they have other children the way parents are supposed to? So many, many children have this fantasy, beginning maybe, 5 and 6 and on from that, that they are orphans. And they keep that up for a while. And then in adolescence, the desire comes because in the society that we live in now, adolescents stay at home far longer than they used to. So between, say, 15 and 18, they're extremely impatient to get away, and they feel that they could manage quite well on their own, as we saw in the 60s when people, in fact, did do that.
In your book, you write about some writers who wish that they were orphans, too. You mentioned several of them.
Yes, Joyce Johnson, for example, who in her book gives an account of what happened to many people. I used her because she dramatizes it, who began being a truant from home, that is to say, spending her day in a way that her parents didn't know she was spending it, and collecting her money and waiting for the moment when she could make the break and live outside of the home. And in my time in college, I certainly wanted to do that, but it turned out that many of my friends whose situations looked to me fairly comfortable wanted to do it too. One of the reasons they wanted me to come and live with them is they thought that if I was in the household, somehow the whole dynamics of the household would change. And they were less determined to get out on their own than I was, but they had the desire.
My guest is Eileen Simpson. She's the author of the new book, Orphans, Real and Imaginary. And we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a few seconds. This is Fresh Air. Writer Eileen Simpson is my guest, and we're discussing her new book, which is titled Orphans, Real and Imaginary. It's part memoir and part social history. We were talking about friends of yours and also people in the literary world who've imagined themselves to be orphans and who've kind of romanticized what their lives would have been like if they were not tied to their real past. You fell in college and thereafter with a circle of artists. You married the poet John Berryman, and for years, most of the circle of people that you traveled in were all artists, and I wonder if they thought that you were more exotic or interesting by virtue of being an orphan.
I think that John Berryman did. Yes, in fact, they did. I now remember that Delmore Schwartz, when he was casting The Wings of the Dove, well, you know, we were pretending that we were going to dramatize it, gave me the role of Millie. And I'd forgotten all about that until I began to write about The Wings of the Dove for this book. But Millie, of course, is a completely orphaned heroine who has so few ties to life that, of course, in the end, there isn't a sufficient tie to keep her in this world, and she dies.
One of the ironies, I think, is that some of the poets in the circle that you were in were fairly helpless in the real world. they were great when it came to writing, but when it came to keeping order in the house, washing a dish,
driving a car,
any practical thing, they just fell to pieces. And as the wife of a poet, it was kind of your job to navigate through reality and to almost play a mothering kind of role.
Yes, I suppose that's true, and I think it was true of the other wives as well. I was just thinking in the business of driving a car in that group of men that I knew. They all could drive, but it was far better if they didn't, as they realized, because they were so preoccupied most of the time. I remember that Edmund Wilson never drove. Many of them didn't. Well, I mean, that's a practical thing that really, it's hard to get through life nowadays without driving a car. And I have a feeling that the newer generation of poets all drive. I mean, there is a difference somehow.
Did it feel odd to you to be in this almost mothering kind of role, having
no? I think
not
I
had
have
a mother.
I think I must have a strong drive in that direction. I'm a feeder and protector, and I think I would not have become a therapist without having that. I think that's. Is it? It occurs to me now. An attempt to give to others what I didn't have. That's, you can always deal with any such situation two ways, be unable to do it or to do it to make up for your loss. And maybe that's what I was doing.
You know, I read your book, Poets in Their Youth, your memoir of those years with John Berryman several years ago, and something that really stands out in my mind is the way you compared being a poet's wife to being a coal miner's wife.
Yes.
And that it was actually a very hazardous position to be in.
Yes. That is to say, you know, you never knew when there was going to be an explosion in the mine, in a way, and the terrible anxiety about money and impermanence and living on the edge. I mean, unlike coal miners, these poets, there were always possibilities. Maybe they'd get a grant or maybe they'd get an award. But it was so uncertain about money for all of them, and it was difficult to get jobs. I mean, nowadays it's different because there are so many grants and so many universities that have creative writing courses and so forth. But in those days, it was very difficult.
Did you start writing only after you split up with the poet John Berryman?
Oh, much later than that. It wasn't until I remarried and went to live in Paris. People have asked me if, since I began late, was it because he suppressed my desire to write and so forth? No, not at all. It never even occurred to me to write until I went to live in Paris. And when I got there, I discovered that it was illegal for me to practice because I was a foreigner.
To practice as a psychotherapist.
Psychotherapist. And the rules were very strict. And so I was completely disoriented in the beginning. And then I spent a year writing an article about the psychoanalytic milieu in Paris, so that took my interest. And when I finished that, for the first time in my adult life since I was 18, I was out of work. And I remember the day very well. I was sitting, we had a garden behind the apartment that we lived in, and with this extraordinary newfound leisure, I was sitting there one day. It was a beautiful June day. For a change, it was not raining in Paris. And suddenly I had an idea for a story. And it was so surprising to me that it really, I felt anxious. I felt frightened by the idea. And I rather dispelled it, but it kept the story kept coming back. And it was about a maid. It was about a bon à tout faire in the household. And then, really quite reluctantly, in a week or so, I got out paper and I began to write. And I was so furtive about it that I didn't even tell my husband for some time, till he remarked on the fact that I seemed either dreamy or distractible. And from then on, I began writing, but very timidly. And when I came back from Paris, still unable to begin my practice because I had to really get back into the life of New York, which had changed radically in 4 years in the 60s, I continued to write.
You've written at least one novel, but three of your books have been memoirs.
Yes.
And I think you just write so well about yourself, and you have the gift of writing about your own life in a way that other people can identify with. Your life becomes just an example of many lives. And I wonder why you all have chosen your life as a subject matter for your writing as opposed to novels.
You know, I haven't chosen it. I am quite surprised at it. First of all, if anybody had said to me 15 years ago, you are going to begin to be a writer and you're going to write about your own life, I would have said, but I don't have anything to write about. I mean, I haven't had the most commonplace life. I can't see what there would be of interest in it. And then when I began to write, after I wrote the first draft of the novel, I began to write short stories. And it was not through any plan at all that I went from fiction to nonfiction. And each time when I finish a book, I have an idea for a novel that's circulating around the edge of my brain, but it's not ready yet. And it's always rather surprising, what is the subject of the next book going to be? First, you have the feeling there is no subject. There's never going to be another book. You almost hope there won't be by the time you finish writing.
Stop and the agony.
That's right. Enough turbulence. But then an idea comes, and I found myself writing another book of nonfiction, but absolutely without plan.
In the beginning of your new book, you explain that it was the loss of your second husband that in a way led to the writing of this book, because experiencing his loss brought you back to the experiences of being an orphan as a child. Will you write about the experience of losing your husband?
Was I?
Will you ever write about the experience of losing your husband?
I don't know. In a way, I feel I have written about it in this book, because the first chapter, there's a lot in the first chapter that's really about grief before I get to the orphan experience. I don't know. Now, that's interesting. About, maybe 5 years ago, an agent asked me if I wouldn't like to write a book about grief and widowhood? And I said, absolutely not. At that time, I couldn't have handled it as a book. I was still experiencing it. So I can never say what I will or will not do because I don't know. It's always mysterious to me. I have no plan to, though.
At the end of your book about orphans, you describe returning to the convent boarding school, which is one of the places that you grew up as a child, and it was closed down, and the person there told you, well, there are no orphans anymore. What did that make you think about?
Well, first of all, it was a terrible shock to me that the villa was no longer there. I had had the shock of coming back to the United States and finding that the street where my grandparents lived, 28th Street, in Manhattan, not only was the brownstone not there, but the street had been destroyed. That's very unusual. They built a housing project that destroyed the street. And I feel very strongly about the monuments from my childhood, like Pennsylvania Station. I've never reconciled myself to that having been destroyed. And so when I went back to look for the convent to check on some details, it never occurred to me that that wouldn't be there. So it was gone. Not only was it gone, but there was a new institution, and it was an institution for the elderly. And it was, I hadn't really taken in what that switchboard operator said, you know, so glibly, parents don't die anymore. She meant parents don't die young. And so it made me think over the whole question of orphans as a passing phenomenon, or changing phenomenon at any rate.
Eileen Simpson, I want to thank you very much for talking with us and for being here. Thank you for coming. My guest has been Eileen Simpson, and her memoir about her childhood as an orphan is titled Orphans, Real and Imaginary. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.